is tape number 405, September the 7th, 1979, side 2, Mae Bressel and Carmel. Walter Layton said that Roy William Dale, according to the Santa Rosa newspaper, was what he called a model tenant. He had no financial problems. He kept to himself for 8 years. He lived in a studio apartment. He left the apartment every morning, and he returned every evening, and they assumed he had a well-paying job somewhere. They never located an employer in 8 years, so he must not have had a cash from any business or corporation or any known skill, and he returned home every evening. Evidently, he, as I say, paid. He had no bank accounts or no record of savings or cash. He just simply existed for 8 years in this studio apartment. They tried to contact a firm where he was supposed to have employed, his last employer, and they contacted this one firm, but that firm had stopped production a year ago, and it didn't say what they made. The sheriffs in Santa Rosa are just riddled with curiosity, as is the federal government. They didn't say what kind of a place it was or what kind of work he was skilled at. The place had been out of business 6 months, and evidently there are no bank accounts, no receipts. Everything was done in cash. He had two hobbies. One was watching TV, and the other is bowling. As I read the account of this man, this Roy William Dale, I think of that mind control center in Sedona, Arizona, that was used for brainwashing. And a woman told me about her friend's husband, who is a literal zombie, who was brainwashed in Sedona, and that he was involved some way in the Kennedy assassination, but he doesn't know how, and how his mind is controlled, and how tragic it is. And I'm just wondering how many vegetables we have in this country supported with just enough to get by, cash in and out, and then he'd sit home and watch TV. This man, Roy William Dale, if you believe Mr. Layton, left every morning, came home every night, and he went bowling. He never had a single visitor, a man or a woman, in 8 years in his place, and he had one unpaid phone bill at the apartment. Everything else was paid up. He had a phone, and somebody heard the phone ring, because later he left and he never came again. He was found dead. He received a phone call. Remember how Candy Jones tells about people in the CIA getting instructions telephonically to kill themselves? She was supposed to kill herself after working for the CIA X amount of years, and Long John Neville had saved her. This man got a telephone call and evidently went up and was found dead on this road with this ridiculous note of the Kennedy assassination. When it talks about the big H, besides H.L. Hunt, there was Richard Helms involved in the assassination and E. Howard Hunt in the assassination. And I wonder if this isn't a message, three down and two to go, would apply to those men if they aren't getting orders now to be quiet, in case, because so many of their co-workers have been killed. This person received phone calls at the house. He had one unpaid bill. But when they wanted to check the phone connections to see where his calls went and so forth, they found some phone numbers. And when they called these phone numbers that were among his belongings, every one of those was a disconnected line. Some phones didn't answer at all, and others answered and said they didn't know who it was. And not one of them admitted knowing him. So that the numbers they had were either disconnected, non-existent, or the people made him a non-person. This reminds me very much of Alternative 3, with trying to find out if there was a Sir William Valentine at Jodrell Bank. The secrecy that's going on with KGO or the communications, they don't answer letters, even though it's written up in a book as nonfiction. This same thing is taking place here, where Roy William Dale has these numbers, but either they're not connected, or no one answers them, or they don't know him. Now, there is no record of his existence to put the pieces together. There wasn't a single receipt in his room. There wasn't a bill for anything he bought. There were no payroll stubs. There was no evidence that he has a checking or savings account. There were no keys. There was no evidence that he had a safe deposit box. There were no credit cards in his name, no books or magazines or periodicals that came to him that he could order, that maybe they could check his handwriting. The only thing they had was a 1972 edition of the London Times with a picture of his sister. Now, again, the federal government isn't in on this case. The Santa Rosa sheriffs are limited both in purpose, intent, capability, and funds. They haven't pursued. No investigative journalist has asked, well, what is his sister's name? What was the article about? What did she do in London in 1972? Remember, all the action and money from London to go down to Jonestown took place around 73. But why was her picture in the paper? Who is she? What is her name? In other words, what is this family, the family that belongs to Roy William Dale, doing, and why is her picture in the paper? They described him as very meticulous, every hair in place, no dirty clothing in the apartment. He had a bowling ball that was carefully wrapped up. He had a 1974 Chevrolet car, and he took care of the engine and kept it clean. No food in the apartment, just two cans on the shelf. And for 7 years, that's the way he existed. It's very tragic. It reminds me of the most macabre kind of a situation for a play, to think that people exist like this. And there's some way, of course, linked to the intelligence community. Otherwise, they couldn't get rid of all these clues. So what, no one knows how he got any money, where it came from, how he occupied his time when he left in the morning and came back at night. When he was dead, they found $8 on him. The landlord was surprised. Now, the landlord must know more about him, Mr. Layton, than he's saying, because he thought he had $8,000. He described him as a high roller. He said he had, again, those well-known Las Vegas connections. He made frequent trips to Nevada. He had been to Reno. That was the only clue, is that 2 days before his death, 36 hours before he was found, he had been at Reno. They're not saying how they knew he'd been at Reno, what he was doing at Reno, and the police wouldn't reveal that clue. They've compared the pen in his possessions to the pens of the note, and the ink that he had to the block printing and the handwriting to the note. And as of this day that I'm making this tape, there isn't a thing in the news about this Roy William Dale. You know, this lack of identity is one of the things that worried me, so I did a tape about my daughter who was going with this person for two years and 2 months, and she isn't seeing him anymore. He's moved to Los Angeles, off the Monterey Peninsula. But within a month of their association, and certainly into the first year, I went to every police department and the FBI and kept a record, because this man had no means of support. He had no occupation or place where he worked. He didn't have to go out. He went out in the day or came back at night. There was no noticeable ID. He was in an empty room, and all he had was a book called Shogun, and there were no records and no possessions, and it was as if he had a car, but if a crime were committed by him or he were on instructions, and I had that fear that he was, he could disappear from the face of the earth and nobody would trace him. He had no magazine subscriptions. He had no telephone. He had no telephone in his name all the years they lived on the peninsula. He had no P.O. box. He just picked up at general delivery. He had access to X amount of money to take care of bare necessities with no food or stock, just a little hot plate. Didn't appear to eat, but was very well-rounded and met people at places, their local clubs and bars where he could go. But he had no noticeable means of what was behind him or his motivation or where he was going. There are plain white walls, a bare place, and the landlord is linked to the Central Intelligence Agency. And I thought it was a safe house, and this person had, other than just existing, he had no busy contacts with his family. A brother on the local police department in Dallas, Texas, was there when Kennedy was killed and still works for the Dallas Police Department. But if anything had happened to my daughter, there would be no way to trace this man or handwriting. There weren't pieces of paper around or things to check him out, other than a driver's license that he had with his car. There was no police record. There was no ID. And I always worry about these mysterious people who just fade and fade away and exist with no support, with no people knowing or coming in or reaching them and just moving around. That's what they really are bodies that just move but have no day-to-day contacts or stability. And that was what was worrying me right from the beginning. The similarities between this man and that person still stay in my mind, what I went through just following and making note of all that. Well, we'll keep this, and I'm sure I will update it, or there'll be something, or maybe there won't be. But this confession note, or the mention on the dashboard of the Kennedy assassination, again diverting it from the Defense Intelligence Agency, from DISC, from the Defense Industry Security Command, from the Nazis, from the real assassination teams, putting a note there on the dashboard. Maybe, as I say, it was a note for Richard Helms or E. Howard Hunt that it would happen to them. It's impossible that the window car was sealed from the outside and a canvas thrown over it and no traces of those anisins in his stomach. And his mysterious life, this tragic, mysterious life of the past 8 years in a place rented by Mr. Layton, all of it is queer. It has no answers, and I've just thrown out to you what's been in the news so far, and as I say, we'll follow it later. There was an interesting article last week about the U.S. scientific groups asking the fate of 14 Argentinians, and it reminds me of the alternative three, or possibly there are 10,000 to 20,000 people actually missing in Argentina. But according to the news reports, the Associated Press, two prestigious groups of scientists and engineers want to account for science engineers and students who are living in Argentina. They've disappeared and their rights have been violated, and they're looking for 10 scientists, an engineer, a science student that either have disappeared or in jail. And they listed the names of them. One is an electronics engineer, the other a physics student, another a physician, one a chemistry professor. There's a chemist physicist, a physician, another chemist, an urban planner, a statistician, and a psychologist. Now, these people have been missing, and the allegations are that since the military government seized power in March of 76, they can't find these people. I wonder if, by any chance, they're missing because of any plans like space stations and so forth. Are these urban planners removed on that basis, or are they political prisoners? There was some reason to believe that some of them weren't involved politically against the Argentine government, and yet they're missing. I wonder if the U.S. scientific organization would get the book, Alternative 3, if they could deny that these exist, these missing people, or if they would go ahead and look for the people that those television programs had talked about in London. There also was another article this week, Argentine warms up to the Soviets as ties with the U.S. cool. They're kind of disgusted with the human rights group that the United States is forming and visiting, and they are lining up with the Soviets. You may ask yourselves, well, why in the world would they go to the Soviet Union when the United States is talking about the loss of human rights in Argentina, Uruguay, Ethiopia, and so forth, if they are so much against human rights, and the Soviet Union knows and experienced the wrath of the Nazi regime, why would the Soviet Union be working with the Argentinians, the assassination teams that, by killing our heads of state, have allowed the escalation of the Cold War against the Soviet Union? The Brzezinskis and the Kissingers are all in power because of the succession of murders of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, the civil rights leaders, and so forth. Are the Russians so stupid that they would line up with Argentine? Well, it was just a few years ago, August 23rd, 1939, if you can go back that far, when German Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, arrived in Moscow to make a pact with Stalin. It was called the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and it was just a month before World War II broke out. Hitler and Stalin got together, and they decided that they would combine and divide up the world. And the Russians were so stupid, Israelis aren't the only people that make mistakes, that they lined up with Adolf Hitler, and Hitler invaded Poland, and that was what triggered World War II at that time. At that time, the whole world was very secure. There were cliches going around, and Harrison Salisbury printed some of them in the New York Times last week, that France had a strong army, that the Maginot Line would hold, that the Royal Air Force would beat off Mr. Goering's Luftwaffe, that Germany would never fight war on two fronts. I really don't know how world leaders are so stupid. If people like yourself and myself can sit and figure out some of these things, I don't know how they can make one mistake, and I don't know how they can double up and make another mistake. I think the lining up of Argentina with the Soviet Union now is just to tease the United States, and they will throw the Soviets to the wolves as soon as they're ready. Everything in their administration, their policies, is anti-Soviet, And I can't imagine why they make overtures to the Soviets, because the United States are asking about these missing peoples and the various prisons or tortures. Certainly the use of the tortures and the use of the prisons in Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, Chile, Argentina is to keep the socialists or the people's movements and the labor movements from getting into power and breaking the backs of the people to keep them in slavery. So I can't imagine who in the Soviet government would make overtures or sit down with Argentina at this time. And certainly all it can do is have the same effect of the Hitler-Stalin pact, where just a short time later the Nazis were attacking Russia. In 1939, in August, they were sitting down and talking as buddies. By June of 41, they were attacking the Soviet Union. I don't understand the heads of states or how they work, but I'm just sharing with you some of the information that we are reading in the newspapers, and I do wonder if the fate of the missing scientists in Argentina could just coincidentally, again, have anything to do with what they were saying in Britain about the missing scientists and the projects for the space colonies. There are some very important steps being taken among certain individuals. It's like a ballet to watch them that will affect the 1980 elections, and we must call attention to those now and share this information to project the possibilities of what will happen in the future. The first most frightening move is the placement of Kenneth Reitz to the staff of Mike Curb. He's going to take over a 25-person staff starting in 1980, and I would say that unless Jerry Brown is very cautious and exposes both Mike Curb's connections to organized crime and the Ken Reitz connections to the CIA and dirty tricks, then Governor Brown could never possibly live to be president of the United States, even if he had a chance through the polls, which is questionable. But this is a lethal team. This Mike Curb was running for lieutenant governor against Merv Dimerly. Dimerly was scheduled for that fatal plane crash, the PSA in San Diego last year, and he took the plane, the Sunday evening plane, instead of the Monday plane. And it's taken all this time, almost a year of investigations, to try and find out what happened to cause that plane crash and how somebody just happened to be there photographing it at that exact moment. The mystery of that crash has never really been resolved. Mike Curb is lieutenant governor. He's a terribly ambitious man with no qualifications. He's been battling our present governor, Jerry Brown, to make important decisions of judges and on the appeals court here. The battle between them has even gone to court to try to stop his actions when Jerry Brown is out of the state. Well, Ken Reitz ran Mike Curb's election campaign last year, and he also managed Evel Younger's campaign for the governor. Of course, both of those men, Younger is linked to the Defense Department and the CIA. He owns his own public relations firm. He worked for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer with Robert Haldeman's son. MGM has been linked, of course, to CIA and high government officials. Their casinos and so forth have been linked to the CIA, some of their money. Ken Reitz went from Washington out there. He worked for Richard Nixon's re-election campaign in 1972. He admitted that he was involved in dirty tricks, but his admission got him out of ever being charged. He was never charged with the crime or anything wrongdoing like subterfuging our entire electoral process. He did testify before the Watergate grand jury, only the grand jury, and he was freed of any involvements, even though the entire selection of candidates was manipulated by the Dirty Tricks Department. Worse than that, Ken Reitz's name was linked to some very secret funds, very dangerous funds. It went through Robert Haldeman, and I'd written an article for Midnight on the death of witnesses at the time of the Watergate story, and some of these people that were killed were linked to this Ken Reitz Haldeman fund. One was Webster, James Webster, and the other was James Glover. They were key aides, congressional aides, to Congressman Mills. William Mills, the congressman, was found shot dead in Maryland. He was 48 years old, and allegedly $25,000 had gone to his fund from a very secret $1.7 million secret fund that touched, allegedly, the Ken Reitz Haldeman pockets and the committee to reelect the president. Mills lived in Maryland, where George Wallace was shot. We don't know whether Artie Bremmer got any of this $25,000 that paid for his air flights to Canada or up to Michigan, or staying at the Waldorf Astoria, the Marriott hotels. It's not explained yet. Nobody hears from Bremer. He's somewhat of a zombie who financed the shenanigans of his. But money was going into Maryland. William Mills was dead. Then his two aides were killed. And also there were other deaths, many deaths, linked to Watergate witnesses. But Reitz was part of that Dirty Tricks group that was linked to the funds of Haldeman. And now he's in the state of California, and he is in charge of the lieutenant governor's office for a salary of $42,000 a year, which is outrageous that a Nixon dirty tricker would be in charge of the lieutenant governor's offices at this time when Watergate was hardly even tried or exposed. Another break of political significance is that of Lynn Nofziger quitting the Ronald Reagan camp. I was sure that Reagan would be the selected candidate for the presidency, but I think now that he's being moved out in hopes of John Connally. Reagan is an outsider like Jimmy Carter is from Georgia. Reagan has never been in Washington. John Connally knows the ropes. He's Secretary of the Navy, Secretary of the Treasury. He has that compound down in Tyrol Bay where the assassins went to Oaxaca, Mexico, and came out of Chile. He knows the assassination teams. He was with John Kennedy when he was assassinated. He still wears a bullet from the second gunman that he walks around with in his leg that hasn't been totally removed. John Connally comes from the center of the United States, which is the Texas oil area. Leon Jaworski was selected. He was part of the Nuremberg cover-up, the Kennedy cover-up, the Watergate cover-up, the Koreagate cover-up. He's from the Houston CIA activities, and Texas oil people have a big stake in the Middle East, and Connally, for any number of reasons, from covering the assassination teams to his Middle East posture, is much more important than Reagan at his old or middle age. And it's for this reason, and the splits in the Reagan camp, that Lynn Nofziger dropped out this week. Now, he's been a longtime Reagan supporter. He made an interesting statement this week that he wanted to get out of the camp. What is going on? I don't know what he knows. But what he said in the Los Angeles Times is, the way things are going, I want out. And he resigned from the Reagan camp. During the 1972 elections, Lynn Nofziger was important, working with as a go-between between the committee to reelect the president, again, that Haldeman-Ehrlichman fund, who went to G. Gordon Liddy in the Treasury Department, and down to U. Sloan, then went to Lynn Nofziger, and he worked in California with Joseph Tomasi of the Nazi Party. He brought them to Washington, D.C., and met members of the Nazi Party there. Nofziger had Robert Walker, a member of the American Independent Party, pay the Nazi Party to encourage the votes to go to the American Independent Party, and he was trying to get county officials to purge the voting lists of all of the American Independent people, getting ready for the Republicans to take over wherever they could. As I say, he was meeting at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington in 72 with John Mitchell and Harry Dent, a counsel to the president, and also with Glenn Parker, another Nazi, at the Hilton Hotel in October of 71. John Mitchell and G. Gordon Liddy and Lynn Nofziger, and this can of dirty worms and dirty politics were all linked together. And then Lynn Nofziger went on and worked with Gerald Ford in his campaign, and then worked for Ronald Reagan. He was Reagan's press secretary in his campaign in 1966 when he was the governor. He spent 2 years working for Richard Nixon, and then he was deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee in 1971. At this point of the game, he's leaving Ronald Reagan, which shows there's a split in the Reagan camp, and Reagan hoped in September in San Diego there'd be a convention of the Republicans, that he would show strength, and now the support or the underpinnings under the aged Ronald Reagan, it seems, are being whittled away. Nofziger, Ken Reitz, Evel Younger were all part of the Dirty Tricks can of worms. And even though Reagan was a governor of California and a staunch political conservative, he isn't as deeply involved into these cans of worms or manipulating the power structure like the old-timers. And I think they really need the expert from Tyrol Bay, from the Defense Industry Security Command, the old guard, John Connally, to cover the fort. They can do it in the next elections. Maybe put Young Haig as vice president and then get rid of Connally and have our military commander in the White House. The third big move this past week was to have Richard Vegery take all of his computer tapes and his computerized expertise to John Connally. He's going to support John Connally for president. He said he's not conservative enough. I think I mentioned on another tape, one of Meet the Press, or one of the shows said that this particular party wanted John Connally because he wanted a one-term presidency and wouldn't be afraid to make war in the Middle East. Well, John Connally isn't as conservative as Richard Vegery, but Vegery is from the Young Americans for Freedom, and I have been promising for a long time, and maybe I'll do it in the next week or two, a tape on the YAF and the Kennedy assassination. The links of Robert Morris and the Young Americans for Freedom and E. Howard Hunt and Douglas Caddy and that group to the murdering of John Kennedy. And again, it goes back to Connally and Tyrol Bay. So it's very important that Vegery from the YAF put all of his power not behind Reagan or Crane, because they need to cover up still those killings that are very ripe for investigation, and the Justice Department is still leaving it open. Vegery has gone to the Connally camp. He's in Virginia, and he has computers. He's raised money for Jesse Helms and for Mr. Crane, and he is there to turn the entire Congress into a conservative body identical to Hitler's election in 1933. This is his goal, and he is trying to turn the country very conservative, and he apologizes that Connally isn't far right enough, but maybe he'll be able to get him more right, and that they agree on a certain percentage of ideas, and so that he's going to put his full weight. So the moving of Ken Reitz up to Sacramento in charge of the entire lieutenant governor's office, the leaving the camp Nofziger, leaving the Reagan camp, and Vegery taking on Connally, means that all of those teams connected with dirty tricks in the past are tightening their muscle and getting ready for the 1980 elections, and they'll move into position. There was a gentleman named Alexis Watson Castillo who told ABC that he was coached by members of the Defense Intelligence Agency, a retired Army General Daniel Graham, who also worked as a deputy director of the CIA at one time. And Castillo said that he was paid $6,000 to lie about the Panama Canal and to make statements about his own government in the 1978 news conference about corruption in Panama, that he was paid $6,000 by Mr. Lasalt, the brother of Senator Paul Lasalt from Nevada. Lasalt has been managing the Ronald Reagan campaign, and again it was Richard Vegery who gave his efforts and computers and money to Senator Helms to vote against the Panama Canal Treaty and stir up those votes at the time that that decision was made in Washington on the treaty. The Dirty Tricks Department surfaces. Mr. LaSalle said he wouldn't dignify these allegations by any comments, but why would a man come forward and say that he was paid this $6,000? It's Mr. LaSalle who's managing the Ronald Reagan campaign for president, and that he founded this Citizens for the Republic. That's the one that funds Reagan speeches all around the country, and he's been behind the Summa Corporation and the defense industry behind Reagan. It'll be interesting to see if and when or how they make their switch to John Connally, or where the split is in the decision to move to Connally. But the point is that these dirty tricks appear and reappear, and nobody is charged, and there's just a remark, I won't dignify it with a denial. And yet those people that are able to wheel and deal and pay off and computerize votes and mailing lists and affect what should be a free electoral process are out there, and they're working very hard to get a government much further right, as Vegery says, than John Connally. The Pope is very much in the news, and next week, we don't have time on this tape, I'll go into the politics of the Vatican. I did several tapes on that when he first came into power. We'll update it, and some the financial update of the Vatican, missing Michele Sindona, and what it means to John Paul's visit to the United States. As Jack Anderson wrote, his visit to Poland stirred up the Russians and caused a large economic and psychological problem, and he's here to create this anti-communist spectacle. He's the most political pope that's ever been in office. Well, I take that back. They're all political, but he's very visible, and he doesn't mind meeting before millions of people with this image of the peacemaker while he stirs the blood and tempers for World War III. That's why I resent him so much, I suppose. Our time is out now. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and I'll be back with you next week, and you take care.